This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Kelly Anissa. World Refugee Day is celebrated worldwide each year on the 20th of June as a salute to the world's refugees, and this year's theme is to take a step with refugees. Today's show looks at the current situation faced by refugees in Malaysia and the opportunities for protection under the new administration. Joining me on the show today is Maya Lazish. She is the UNHCR Deputy Representative. Welcome to the show, Maya.
Thank you very much.
So I just want to start off with a quick one-on-one on the matter. What is the difference between a refugee and a migrant? Because so often I know people confuse one for the other or assume that they are the same.
That's a great question. Thank you for that. Indeed, there are differences between economic migration and refugees. So one of the first differences that I would highlight is that refugees don't choose to leave. They are usually forced to leave because of war or because of persecution. And in the 1951 convention relating to the status of refugees, it's very well defined who a refugee is. So you have to leave your country, you have to cross a border, and you have to be persecuted for five reasons, which are linked to belonging to a specific social group, for reasons of nationality, race, political opinion, and religion.
Right. So why is that distinction so important, especially when we look at the refugee crisis globally?
So it's very important because, well, first of all, it indicates when refugees flee in big numbers, it obviously has an indication of a very bad state of affairs in their home country. Mm. But there's also quite a significant distinction because refugees often flee without anything in their hands. They don't want to leave their country, but they're forced because that's the only way that they will save their lives or find security. So going to other countries, it's extremely important that receiving countries recognize their plight and are able to understand why they're coming and that it's not out of their free will, but that they will need assistance. So they're often in a very basic and poor condition and will have gone through very traumatic experiences. And they come very often as families. So it will be grandparents, it will be children, and so forth.
And how many refugees do we have today globally?
So it's never been worse, basically. In terms of displacement, and I'll break that down for you, we are operating with up to 70 million people in the world. That is a record number in history. Out of that number, there are just 25.5 million refugees alone. Then there's another just over 3 million asylum seekers, and the 40 million that would then bring it up to 70 is internally displaced. So internally displaced are people who are basically refugees, but they haven't crossed the border. And they're displaced within their countries most often because there is a war or there's been a natural catastrophe.
And where are the majority of these refugees from?
So today, one of the biggest crises we have is clearly Syria. Afghanistan continues to be a large crisis. We now, unfortunately, have Venezuela in South America, where we're seeing an outpour of refugees. Mm. Myanmar, unfortunately, is more closer to home in the Southeast Asian region, is one of the larger refugee producers as well. But then, there's still some. Somalia, and there's most certainly Yemen, where we have a devastating war going on.
Right. And what is the refugee situation like here in Malaysia?
Mm. So in Malaysia, you have around 174,000 refugees and asylum seekers. These are the numbers that are registered with UNHCR. They are predominantly from Myanmar, so over 84-85% of that population comes from Myanmar, different minorities. Okay. Half of the total number of refugees and asylum seekers are the ethnic Rohingya from Myanmar. Mm. of whom you might know that there's a million in Bangladesh hosted as refugees yeah. right now. So the situation for refugees and for asylum seekers is challenging in Malaysia because there is no refugee policy, meaning there is not a recognition of their presence on the territory, giving them temporary stay and giving them work rights and sort of access to some of the basic services like education and health. There are some obstacles there. So they are here, but they are not here in a way.
Right. And they are treated as migrants, right? I mean, illegal immigrants in the country because we do not have any basic protection needs for them or we do not recognize them as refugees.
That's right. And by and large, they would be treated as undocumented. We've been working for many years with the immigration and with law enforcement and with the refugee card that UNHCR provides to refugees. Most of the time, immigration and law enforcement will be able to scan it. There's a mm-hmm. QR code on that card. It has very, very strong features, 10 fingerprints, iris scan, and so on and so forth. So that has, through our work with authorities, that has served as a measure of releasing people on the spot. However, that's not always the case, and we still see refugees in detention, immigration detention, mm-hmm. so not criminal offences, but simply for not being documented. They would be detained, and we would have to try and see how we could get them released. So at any given time, we have at least 1,000, maybe over 1,000 people in detention across the 11 immigration detention centres in Malaysia.
I see. And you mentioned 174,000 in Malaysia. Is there an increase yearly or has that number been stagnant? And because I know Bangladesh is taking in a lot of
Rohingya. A lot of people, exactly. Yes. No, that's a very interesting question because it's not visible from some of the statistics that we have been showing, and we're working on this to sort of give a more precise picture. Mm-hmm. You know, we have been in Malaysia since 1974-5, and we have gone through different refugee waves in Malaysia. There's been the Vietnamese, the mm-hmm. Achenese, there's been different groups, and it's always gone up and down. It goes up in a peak for a moment, and then it goes down.
Right.
And it has never really been in significant large numbers if you look at it proportionally to the presence of both legal and illegal economic migrants. Mm. So that's a very, you know, significant difference to look at because we're talking about millions in the one category and then 174,000 in the other category. We don't really think that there's a yearly increase if we talk about new arrivals, and that's an important distinction. So there are not new arrivals coming to Malaysia in any significant numbers. In fact, it's completely negligent. Mm. What has happened since the change of government in Malaysia is that we have seen people who have been staying here, predominantly Rohingya and Myanmar ethnic minorities, who have been staying here for years and years and years and years, come forward to register.
Right.
So in terms of new arrivals, since 2015, it's really been nothing worth talking about. But in terms of the statistics, yes, the numbers have been growing in the past 1 or 2 years, but it's simply because people are coming forward to register because they feel that they can now.
I see. So when you say that they feel more comfortable coming forward now, is it because of the change in administration? You know, what was, you know, what held them back previously?
Mm. I think it's difficult to say that or attribute it to one specific factor. I think the change of administration certainly has brought some reassurances into the picture because there's a lot of discussion around a refugee policy, and there's much more open engagement around this. Civil society is extremely engaged in refugee issues, and the conversation is open with the government, and the government is interested in looking at different ways of dealing with this.
Mm.
Nothing concrete per se right now, but I think by the mere fact that we are having an open and frequent discussion around this, that trickles into the refugee community, and they feel hopeful.
And you know, how does Malaysia and even Bangladesh compare to other countries in the region in terms of our refugee intake?
Well, I think, you know, it's the first thing that I can say is that both Bangladesh and Malaysia are extremely generous. There's the largest refugee population hosted, both in Bangladesh and in Malaysia. I mean, there's quite a difference between Bangladesh and Malaysia in that you have 1 million in Bangladesh and then 174,000 here. But nevertheless, those are the highest number in the region.
And are the countries in the region taking anyone in as well?
It's quite different. I mean, you have a refugee regime in Philippines, for example. You also have it in Cambodia. But Thailand, for example, and Indonesia, they have different ways of dealing with it and don't have a refugee policy either. And this is where, you know, when we look at Malaysia and when we discuss with the government here, it's extremely important that we look at the refugee policy not just as a domestic measure of stabilization and management of a population who's undocumented, but also to see how that contributes to regional stability and how the countries influence each other. I tend to think that, you know, if Malaysia was to show the example of coming through with a refugee policy, which is quite easy in the existing legislation, that, you know, that there would be a trickle effect or a domino effect in certain other countries in the region. And by that, and by that type of collaboration and sort of putting it under the hood of ASEAN, you know, you'd actually be able to also deal with some of the larger problems like the situation in Myanmar being a refugee producing country.
I see. So Malaysia is a developing nation. You know, we don't have any exclusive rights for refugees, as we previously mentioned. And yet there are many refugees who still make the decision to come here, not only from Myanmar, but as you said, Syria, Somalia. You know, again, a land where they don't necessarily enjoy legal protection. Why do you think they choose Malaysia anyway?
Yeah, I think that there are different reasons for different populations. If we just take sort of the global picture, then the fact that you don't need a visa to enter Malaysia makes it very easy to enter the country, and you don't have to be in illegal, at least in the first 3 months of your stay here. So that's definitely easier than most countries where there is a visa or there are... where a visa is enforced and you know, you basically risk arrest upon arrival. So that's a big difference, and that certainly makes a difference for people from Syria, from Yemen, and from Afghanistan, from places like that, that they can land and that they can try and orient themselves and see what to do. I mean, nobody really... You know, people make decisions in going in different directions based on what the opportunities and possibilities are, and usually there are not many. And by the sheer numbers of just the non-Myanmar population, you can see that you know, this is not the prime destination. This is not where people come. The majority of refugees from those countries are in the neighborhood. You know, a lot of Syrians won't even say yes to resettlement to third countries from Jordan and from Lebanon because they're sitting next to the border and waiting to go home one day. And it's important to understand that psyche. Turning to Myanmar, I think for the Rohingya, to be honest, it's clear cut, no? You have to choose between two evils in a way, or two really bad situations. You can stay and endure persecution in Rakhine, and I've worked in Myanmar for several years and worked with that population. That's very, very, very untenable. Or you can cross the border into the most densely populated country in the world, where on top of that, there's another million refugees, and live in a camp and sort of hope that you can make ends meet, right? So the third option is to take a risk and get on a boat and get to Malaysia. Malaysia is attractive for Rohingya because, A, it's a Muslim country. There are Muslims themselves. And B, this is a place where people have sought refuge over years and years and years. So there is a community to connect to. There is somebody who can help you even if you're illegal. And I'm not just talking about UNHCR. I think the majority of the help and support in the community really comes from the community. And it comes from people who are in Malaysian society engaging in supporting Rohingya. And then, of course, there are other minorities who are coming in lesser numbers from Myanmar, and they gravitate here because, A, they escape persecution, but they're able to get jobs as well. Even though it's illegal, there is a shortage of basic labor in Malaysia, and they can, it helps their survival. And, you know, refugees are no different from normal people.
Mm.
They need to feed their families. They need to survive. So one way or the other, they're going to engage in work. They'll do it for lesser of a wage, and they'll do it with, you know, less safeguards than people who are working legally.
Right.
But it will bring food on the table, and that's the primary objective.
I see. So I'm speaking to Maya Lazic. She is the UNHCR Deputy Representative. We are talking about the current situation for refugees in Malaysia in conjunction with World Refugee Day tomorrow on the 20th of June. We will be right back after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. I'm speaking to Maya Lazic. She is the UNHCR Deputy Representative. We are talking about the current situation for refugees in Malaysia in conjunction with World Refugee Day tomorrow on the 20th of June. So, Maya, what are some of the major issues refugees face here? We looked at it from a broader context in that, I mean, there's no legal protection or recognition of their rights. But, you know, what about access to healthcare and education?
Yeah, that's great. That was exactly the two things that I wanted to pick up on. That's our biggest concern, frankly. So if I start with education, the majority of the children, and I believe we're talking about only 35% of school-aged children being in some sort of educational center, which means that everybody else is not. The issue here is that they don't have access to a certified, accredited quality education, something that you would get in public education, in public national education. So they don't have access to schools, and they are learning in learning centers which are generously provided by different organizations across Malaysia, but only covering a fraction of the students, and many of them not able to follow a recognized curriculum or being able to sit exams and be certified. Some are through international systems, but that's really the exception to the norm. So that's a huge problem. And if I can just say a few words about why that is a problem. The problem is that you're keeping generations and generations of children and youth in a vacuum. They don't learn anything. They don't learn to be able to take jobs, to be able to excel, and to be able to pursue their professional dreams and objectives like everyone else around them. That's one thing. The other thing, and even more importantly, by not getting an education, that they, when they have to return to their countries of origin, or if they're resettled to a third country, they have nothing in their hands to be able to integrate or to reintegrate, or particularly when returning to their homes, to be a part of the rebuilding of their homes or to be able to rebuild their communities there. So education is an extremely important investment in refugee children, because many of them around the globe are missing that opportunity, and they're simply left helpless for any other future situation that they face. So this is really, it's not a link to the country that provides the education. It's an investment in those children so that they can take decisions together with the families when the time comes. And the time very often does come, even if it's years and years later. So that's on education. If I look at health is really, you know, it's an easy one. There is access to public health, but the challenge with health is that it's not affordable for refugees. And when I say not affordable, it means that refugees have to pay the same rates as I have to pay as an expat here in Malaysia. And that's extremely expensive.
Right.
You know, I've got my insurance, so my business is covered. You know, when I spent a week in KL Public Hospital with dengue, I paid out of my pocket and I had my insurance cover it. But a refugee is not going to be able to pay up 1% of what I paid. We have negotiated with the health authorities a 50% discount. But even with the 50% discount, the bills still run up 100, 200, 300, 400% of the local rate. So that's one obstacle. The other obstacle is that they don't really have access to an insurance. We did mount an insurance which was called Remedy, where we tried to work around this issue so that we would sort of stabilize the access to health and or the access to affordable health. However, the challenge here is that if it's not compulsory, and if it's not a reasonable rate for health services, then the insurance companies can't cover it. There's simply too many claims, and they run losses. So that unfortunately fell through. Those are the two issues around health. And then there's a third issue that I regret to have to speak about. But there is a circular in circulation for health authorities to report not refugees but any undocumented who come to seek health services. Mm. So this includes refugees, obviously, because they're not documented in the Malaysian government sense of documentation. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen, and it is a risk that refugees run when they go and seek health. It's a deterrent for them to come to the public hospital when they have a serious health challenge, and it's frankly also a risk then for the environment and for the community in Malaysia when people don't seek health care for serious sometimes communicable diseases.
Yeah.
So these are some things that, in our view, can be easily removed. And I think we have some very positive discussions with the health authorities in particular on this. But it requires other authorities to also engage in and to help mitigate this issue.
And what was the rationale behind that?
The circular?
Yes.
I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I think, you know, I think all countries want to control and manage illegal presences or undocumented presences of foreigners, and so I would assume that this was one of the ways that they would want to get to them and to, you know, to basically make sure that they leave the country. That's, you know, every country does that, but not all countries do that through the health sector. Usually, and also in international law, it's said that, you know, your access to health should not be determined by what documents you have or not have.
Yeah. And you mentioned that some of them go to educational centres to get, to study. Why don't all of them have access to these same education centres?
Yeah. Well, again, a very pertinent question. It's really limited resources. You know, there's only so much the UN can do and partners in the civil society can do in terms of resources available. The High Commissioner for Refugees, my organization, we depend on contributions from states. And they have to be then shared globally among hundreds of offices and operations. So it's simply a resource issue. And then when we talk about hosting refugees, I mean, this is our advocacy with the government and the work that we have with the government. The best way and the most economical way to deal with the services that refugees need is to have them included in national systems and then contribute the resources that we have to the national systems so that it's integrated and it's much cheaper, in fact, to make sure that people get the right services and the right quality of services. This is in our Global Compact for Refugees. This is sort of a document that has been developed between states globally In order to reinvigorate the solidarity and support for hosting refugees worldwide. So in many countries where you have much larger refugee populations, Turkey is an example, children are included in the national education system. Mm. They have equal access to healthcare with the locals, and they have the right to work. And the moment you have those elements, you're normalizing the situation for them, and they don't become a burden, and they don't require extra resources in order to keep, you know, parallel systems of learning centers or, you know, health clinics or whatever it might be, right, that is developed in a parallel system to support refugees.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, I know some of them do get to work, although not legally, but what happens to the rest of them?
Well, that's the issue. I mean, the you know, most refugees find work in construction, in service industry, in manufacturing, and it's illegal. And they take that risk, but they have to, because that's, as I said before, that's what brings food on the table. So for most part, that will be the situation. However, there are many people who are destitute. Some have savings, and they're living off their savings that they were able to extract out of the country when they fled. Mm-hmm. You know, not every refugee is poor. You know, refugee doesn't determine, you have lost your many things, but some people will have been able to take some money out of the country and are living off that. Others, unfortunately, will be completely destitute, and they will be dependent on the community taking care of them. So, you know, other families working and then bringing something and then sharing their food or something to that effect. If it's really bad, then they will be begging. And they will be finding other ways, you know, collecting scrap or doing other things to sort of make ends meet. So you will really find many different scenarios in the sort of very varied refugee community of different nationalities and different backgrounds, different education, and different ways of coping.
And you mentioned the community. So some countries, especially, I think, I mean, from what I've read, European countries have taken a more isolationist approach to the refugee crisis. So the reasons for this, I think, ranges, you know, and as a result, there seems to be a sort of xenophobia when it comes to how they view the refugee community. Honestly speaking, what do you think about the relationship between Malaysians and refugees? Mm. You know, are we welcoming? I know we have, I mean, you said that we've been generous with our intake, but that represents, I think, the administration. But what about the people here? What have you seen? What is our relationship like with them?
Well, I think there's two sides to the coin, right? I think the generosity actually is also on the people in Malaysia. I think there's you know, since 2015 when we had the crisis in the Andaman Sea and South China Sea, you know, we've seen boats and, you know, people were dug up from the ground having died in slavery like camps and so on and so forth. There's a serious issue around that, and I think that helped sensitize a lot of people in Malaysia, and I think there is an empathy and compassion for people who are fleeing Myanmar in particular, because that's sort of close to home, and that's what people can understand easier. Then there's the other side of it, which is obviously the way we started the conversation today. There's a difference between refugees and undocumented migrants. And I think that difference is completely invisible to people. Everything's conflated into one pot. And what you see is millions and millions of undocumented in Malaysia. And you see that as a, you know, possibly as a cultural threat, or also a threat to employment maybe, or to services or resources or whatever it might be that people are seeing. Or simply just foreigners. We don't know them. And because we don't know them, we fear them. You know, it's really simple stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think there's lots that can be done to demystify the group of refugees, particularly because they are so contained, and particularly because there's a lot of commonalities, a lot of differences, but also a lot of commonalities. And these people live in the communities. You know, they live in the different communities in Johor, in Penang, in KL, in Selangor, and they mix with the locals. And some have good relations, others don't. As long as we keep refugees in that sort of gray zone where they are illegal, where they don't get to work legally, where they don't move legally, where we keep them uneducated, we don't give them proper access to health, as long as we do that, they're going to be ostracized from society and the communities will have more and more prejudices about them because they will, you know, negative coping mechanisms will be prevalent and people will have to do different things to survive. And that will, you know, that will create prejudice and bad impressions on the local community. The moment we open that up and we explain and we do, you know, proper communication with people on the ground, people who live in those communities, who are the refugees, why did they come? They're humans like us. They are exactly the same. They just had to flee and had to endure something that most of us luckily don't have to endure.
Mm.
Then that's the moment where I think a lot of that fear of the foreign is going to be broken down.
And earlier this year, IDEAS released a report about the economic impact of granting refugees in Malaysia the right to work, which is said to have a positive impact on the Malaysian economy and public finances. So Pakatan has pledged to allow refugees the right to work, to give them the right to work. Has there been any updates on that front at all? Because it has been a year. Have we seen any sort of progress towards achieving that?
I think from our side, I can say that we have had intensified discussions with various parts of the government. Our High Commissioner for Refugees visited Malaysia at the end of April and was able to meet with the Prime Minister, with the Minister of Home Affairs, with the Deputy Prime Minister. We were able to have very frank and open discussions. We've presented different proposals as to how to address some of these issues in sort of a practical and easy way. So I think those discussions are proceeding, and we are certainly engaged with the government in a different way than we've been before, and that's extremely positive. I think the IDEAS paper is extremely helpful. Just like preceding papers from other think tanks and organizations have come through, because there is a win-win argument for Malaysia and Malaysians. It's economic and it's also social. It's also a win-win from a perspective of law and order and security, which is something that is of concern to the administration. It's a simple calculation, basically, you know. If you have an undocumented population, if you want to manage that population, both from a security and law and order perspective, the best thing is to identify them, register them, and then you'll be able to manage. You'll know who is here, and you'll know where they are, and you'll know how to deal with them.
Yeah.
From an economic perspective, IDEAS puts it out very, very, very scientifically and very well. You know, the simple explanation is if you give the people the right to work, they will be contributing to the levies and the taxes. They will be consuming more and they will be paying different other services because they will be able to afford it. And that's, you know, that goes straight into the revenue of the state and helps the society. It also makes them visible, which means that people in the workplace, the employers, the community around them will see them as contributing members of society. And that obviously gives a much better impression and much better relationship. So there's, you know, from the social aspect, it's also a win.
Right. And is it too early to tell how Pakatan has done so far in regards to this issue? I mean, they've made these promises, but has there actually been any solid or definite action that they've taken since they've come into power?
I think we are in a good conversation right now, and I think it's too early to judge the new government on what they've done for refugees. I think we need to give it a little more time. I think there's a lot of priorities in Malaysia. You know, refugees is a priority for us and for our national partners here in Malaysia who are working with refugees. But we have to also understand that Malaysia has to put that into the to the scheme of things. So I think they are actively engaging, and that's really good. But too soon to say anything more about that.
So Malaysia is not party to the 1951 Refugee Convention, and we do not have an asylum system in place regulating that status and rights of refugees in Malaysia. And why do you think we are not a signatory to that convention yet? What do you think that says about our overall position on that matter?
Well, I think signing on to the 1951 Convention on refugees requires that you put a system in place, right? There are some very clear rights and obligations on refugees in the convention, and there are also obligations on the receiving states. And probably, I mean, it's evident that if you don't sign the convention, it's because you don't want to take that, that responsibility. That's the sort of first thing that comes to mind. I think what is really important for Malaysia is to look at what they want to do for refugees and how they want to manage that situation, which has been here. You know, you've had refugees in this country in varying factors over the past 45 years. So there's no reason to sort of push it away. It's here. And refugees will come and go over time, as they do in most countries. So I think if I was to say something encouraging around this, I would say that if the Malaysian government takes some practical steps in refugee protection along the lines of what we've just discussed, you know, temporary stay, work rights, access to affordable health, and you know, take some steps in getting proper education to refugees, that will be the first thing to do, and that will be the best thing to do. And then we can sign the convention later on, and it will be a good signing, because it will be signing the convention on the basis of practical measures being put in place and actually building an asylum system, and that's much better. There are enough places on the globe where the 51 convention is signed and nobody does anything about it. I'd much rather have a situation where Malaysia does that as the cherry on top on some positive steps that they've decided to take.
I see. And what can Malaysians, I mean, what can the people do to help this community? You know, what part can they play in this?
I think first and foremost, keep an open mind. You know, don't judge people in front of you because you don't know them. Be open and engage. Find out who they are. Understand what the difference is. And then there are plenty of, you know, in Malaysia there are so many community initiatives and so many initiatives that try to help those who are worse off in society, whether they're refugees or citizens. And I think there's plenty of places where and organizations that one can engage with in their community. And then speak to, you know, if you believe that this is the right thing to do, speak to your MPs, your parliamentarians, speak to your community representatives, speak to your local police, speak to your local social services and say, hey, let's do something about these people. I think if that comes from the people on the street, from the people in the service of the administration and government in the communities who work with refugees and local communities every day, you know, why spend resources on law enforcement arresting refugees and going into raids? Why spend public resources on keeping them in detention where conditions are not so good? Why spend resources on treating them as undocumented? Why not save some money on that and use it for something that's of benefit for everyone in the community? I think if that message comes from the ground, from people, from everyday people and everyday people in the service of the administration upwards, that's the moment we're going to start seeing some really positive changes for everyone. And I think that's what people can do.
Yeah. And World Refugee Day is on the 20th of June, which is tomorrow. So tell me a little bit more about that. When was this initiated and what is the purpose of this day?
Mm. Oh, you caught me on when it was initiated. It's been going on for years and years and years.
Right.
But I can tell you about what it means.
Mm.
I mean, this is the day, the one day in the year where we pay tribute to refugees who have had the courage and have had to endure some really, really difficult times and have taken what they could take in their hands and left their countries. And we also pay tribute and thank all of those people who have engaged in supporting refugees,
mm-hmm.
whether it's people, you know, living in the communities, whether it's NGOs and other civil society organizations, or whether it's governments who have, you know, instituted asylum systems and taken in refugees. That's the day where we kind of stop for a moment and we pay tribute and we think about all of that and try and see if that moment can inspire us to move on and to be able to better address the situation and stop the situations that produce refugees.
Mm.
I think that's you know one major factor. How do we stop the violence and the persecution that takes place that produces refugees?
And how will World Refugee Day be commemorated this year?
So World Refugee Day is going to be celebrated in a specific way this year. It is calculated that globally, refugees take walk 2 billion kilometres to seek safety.
Mm.
They don't just walk. They take different means of transport as well, but the essence is those 2 billion kilometres.
Right.
And so in order to pay tribute and take measures in solidarity with refugees, we are encouraging the whole world to take steps with refugees so that we can, by 2020, reach 2 billion kilometres in parallel with the 2 billion kilometres that refugees take to seek safety. So people will be doing that through different types of events and personal deeds. There's an app that one can sort of connect to a resource that UNHCR has put out where the steps and the kilometres will be counted. So you can swim, you can walk, you can do fitness, you can run, you can dance, you can do very many different things that will then be counted on this app and produce the calculation. So I think we're going to have a fitness event at Publica on the 14th of July. And we're probably going to see a lot of other sort of events around the country and around the globe that are going to sort of do that solidarity act with refugees.
I see. And I mean, we are running out of time. So before we go, do you have a final message?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be very basic. It's really stop for a moment. Think about your life as a person who lives in Malaysia. Think about your everyday life with your economic challenges, with your social challenges, with your private challenges, with the happiness that you have, with the things that you have, you know, even if you don't have very much. And then think for a moment of the complete opposite of a refugee who has had to leave all of that behind against their choice and with a memory full of violence and persecution, having lost loved ones very often. Think about what kind of life that is and why it would be good to do something for those people, to normalize them, to help them back into a life that you have today.
Mm.
It's a stark contrast. And it really means a lot to sometimes just stop and you know, value the life that you have and understand what you can do for people who don't have that anymore.
Mm. That's a good message to end on. Thank you for joining me on the show today, Maya.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking to Maya Lazic. She is the UNHCR Deputy Representative. We were talking about the current situation for refugees in Malaysia today in conjunction with World Refugee Day tomorrow on the 20th of June. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.